be merciful, be especially merciful.
وَإِذْ قَالَ رَبُّكَ لِلْمَلَائِكَةِ إِنِّي جَاعِلٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفَةً قَالُوا أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَنْ يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءَ وَنَحْنُ نُسَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِكَ وَنُقَدِّسُ لَكَ قَالَ إِنِّي أَعْلَمُ مَا لَا تَعْلَمُونَ.
And mention, O Muhammad, when your Lord said to the angels, "Indeed, I will make upon the earth a successive authority." They said, "Will you place upon it one who causes corruption therein and sheds blood, while we declare your praise and sanctify you?" Allah said, "Indeed, I know that which you do not know."
Any station that is attained by a person must be through the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. They are the wasila, they are the means of nearness, as the Holy Quran says, "Wabtaghu ilayhi alwasila." Seek means of nearness to him. And these means, the true meaning of these means, are the Ahlul Bayt and Imam Hussein, since Safinatul Husayni awsa' wa asra', since his ark is faster and greater. Anyway, we were talking about the fact that the true vicegerents of the Almighty Allah in the earth are the Ahlul Bayt, and they are the means of grace. Ahlul Bayt are truly a means of divine grace, and if it were not for their sake, no one would be blessed with that grace, since they are near to Allah. They are at the station of mercy and certainty. Whoever wishes to reach this station must resort to them first. The Holy Quran says, "Wabtaghu ilayhi alwasila." So it's nearly impossible to reach the station of mercy and certainty about the Almighty Allah without holding fast to His cord. And the Ahlul Bayt are that firm cord of the Almighty Allah. So the light of the Ahlul Bayt is such that even the angels, who are abstract, cannot bear their light. So they fall in prostration when they see their light.
O people, compete with each other in attaining noble traits, and hasten to acquire lofty benefits, and do not count those good deeds which you have delayed.
Allah's vicegerency among people is a feature of the Ahlul Bayt. According to a narration, Imam Ridha alayhi salam has been reported to say, "Al-a'immatu khulafa'ullahi azza wa jalla fi ardi." The imams are Allah's vicegerents on earth. And I assume this is exactly what Imam Hadi alayhi salam says in Ziyara Jami'a al-Kabira. Imam alayhi salam says, "Wa'azzakum bihudah wa khassakum biburhani." He strengthened you with His omnipotence, and He equipped you with His guidance. وَانْتَجَبَكُمْ لِنُورِهِ وَأَيَّدَكُمْ بِرُوحِهِ. He distinguished you with His clear proofs, and He glorified you with His light. وَرَضِيَكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ فِي أَرْضِهِ وَحُجَجًا عَلَى بَرِيَّتِهِ. at the end he chose you to represent him on his earth. In Dua Arafah, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam describes the Ahlul Bayt as Almighty Allah's representatives on the earth, وَخُلَفَائِكَ فِي أَرْضِكَ, and your vicegerents on your lands.
He who loves you admonishes you from wrongdoing, and he who hates you entices you into wrongdoing.
Not only the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam are the vicegerents, but there are also the successors of the Prophet. We have many narrations reported by both Shi'i and Sunni scholars that refer to the Ahlul Bayt as the Holy Prophet's successors. And these narrations are so uninterruptedly reported that there is no doubt about them. And it seems that it is due to their moral, spiritual, and their scholarly features that the Ahlul Bayt alone deserve to be the successors of the Holy Prophet. And this is their divine right, and no one else deserves it, since the Holy Quran reads, لَا يَنَالُ عَهْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ, my covenant does not include the unjust. Brothers and sisters, we will, inshallah, talk about this successorship of the Prophet more in the next programs. Thank you for staying with us. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابك إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابك
يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء
يا وجيها
يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي
اشفع لنا
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the Supreme Leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij in his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Laws from IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, today's first question is about mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and also saying the prayer on time or in the early portion of the time. Let me give you an example. For example, on the day of Ashura, people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before the noon adhan or noon call for prayer. Or on the night before Ashura, they are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before adhan al-Maghrib, before, at the time in the afternoon and before the sunset. And then they hear the call for prayer for like noon prayer in the day of Ashura or the night prayer on the night before Ashura. Now the question is that which is more important, the congregational prayer offered in the early portion of the time or continuing with azadari and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? And I think it happens a lot. I mean, this is a question for many Muslims mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, especially the Shia. As I mentioned, the best example is the 2 days of Tasu'a and Ashura, the 9th and 10th of Muharram, because from early morning people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and then they hear the call for Zuhr prayer. Or we can think of the night, every night of Muharram, some people begin mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before sunset, and then they hear the call for Maghrib prayer. Now the question is that which one is better, to continue with azadari or stop that and say the prayer on time?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, of course we do know that congregational prayer is a prayer which is offered in congregation. It's a wajib prayer offered in congregation. And
Salat is obligatory, congregational prayer is recommended.
Yeah, the prayer itself is wajib, but the congregational prayer is recommended. And of course, generally speaking, praying or offering prayer on time is more important, and precedence should be given to offering prayer on time. Now, to compare congregational prayer with azadari, of course, the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that we should give importance and precedence to offering congregational prayer on time, see, because it's wajib, it is obligatory, mm-hmm. and we have to give importance to an obligatory act rather than a recommended act. Azadari is not wajib. No one considers azadari or mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam to be obligatory, but it is highly recommended, of course. So, as you rightly mentioned, this is one of the frequently asked questions, and of course such incident does take place in different countries. Especially, I believe this event takes place a lot in the Indian subcontinent, because as far as I know, such coincidence takes place. Just as you said, the prayer, the congregational prayer goes on, and at the same time an azadari or a majlis is expected to be held. Now, which one to be given more importance? Obviously, the congregational prayer has to be offered first, and then of course the azadari should be continued. And if it is difficult to stop, of course mu'minin can continue with their azadari, because for example if azadari is already going on, yeah. and if you stop it, the whole ceremony of course will come to an end.
They need to arrange it
the arrangement has to be in such a way that the azadari should not take place at the time of the wajib prayer. It has to come after it.
Stars. see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
and I believe that it is shown by Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself on the day
you're
of
right,
Ashura.
You're right, yeah.
When one of his companions told him that this is the time for Zuhr prayer, and the Imam prayed for him, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam stopped continuing the war, mm-hmm. and he began saying the prayer. And what is important is that Imam lost some of his companions during that prayer.
During that prayer.
It shows the importance of that prayer.
You're right.
And alhamdulillah, we see that recently in these years, at least on the day of Ashura, we see that alhamdulillah, all the mu'mineen, they, as you mentioned, arranged in on their azadari in a way that it finishes at the time of noon prayer. They say the congregational prayer, and then they continue mourning for Imam al-Hasan
al-Assad.
Now, on the same note, Sheikh Jawid, some may ask that we see that some people, again, maybe especially the youth, they like to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam even late at night.
Mm.
And it causes some of them, because they sleep very late at night, then they are sure that it will cause them somehow to lose morning prayer, if we may
put it
this way. And they are not able to wake up early in the morning, and it becomes qaza. So is it something, religiously speaking, encouraged for the youth to do that?
Well, it's absolutely forbidden to miss one's prayer. In the example that you gave, especially the young generation, the teenagers, who have attained puberty, they continue with azadari until late midnight, and then in the morning some of them miss their prayers. That's an unfortunate thing. You know, it's not permissible to let your prayer be lapsed or to be missed. You know, it's very essential to offer your prayers and not to miss them. And also in this time around, you know, everybody has a mobile phone, everybody has access to an alarm clock which
true.
They can wind up and then so that the clock might ring him up and he can offer his prayers. So it's basically very important for every individual to understand the importance of prayer. The importance of fulfilling this duty and offering this and fulfilling this obligation. Prayer is the most important pillar, and of course, if prayer is not accepted, if prayer is not valid, then all other acts of worship will be affected. So if it's rejected, just as there's a saying from Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam and also Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, if prayer is rejected, all other acts of worship, such as fasting, such as azadari, and the likes of such things, will be rejected as well.
At the end of the day, we are talking about an obligatory action like prayer and salat, and a recommended action that is mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So, as you rightly mentioned, the preference should be given to the prayer. And I believe that, first of all, it is the duty of the scholars, especially those who have lectures during the month of Muharram, to explain this fact for the youth who are, their intention is very good because they are going to show the love for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they mourn for him. They love to mourn late at night. But this very important point should be, I believe, mentioned by the great Shia scholars that they can have both. to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam and not to lose the obligatory prayer.
Yes, yes.
And second of all, it's the duty of those, again, who arrange these ceremonies. They can arrange it in a way that, because you see that people like to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam like 1 hour, 2 hours, so they can start the program earlier so that they can mourn and have enough time to sleep also during the night and wake up for the following day.
You're right.
Sheikh Javid, unfortunately we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we'll continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to risk to the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
The light.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza Pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can, because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession. An obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, please accept our condolences on these days of Muharram, which are the days of sorrow for the Ahlul Bayt. Peace be upon them. Now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Today's the eighth day, as we're concluding this eighth day of the month of Muharram. And tonight, brothers and sisters, I want to remember a young man who gave his life as all of the others did on the day of Ashura. A young man known as Ali al-Akbar, the son of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. We know that on that time when they arrived in Karbala on the 3rd of Muharram up until the 9th night of Muharram, that things were wavering back and forth. Things were not clear what was happening. As the enemy troops began to converge in Karbala, and the numbers went from 1,000 to 2,000, all the way up to, as historians say, up to 30,000 troops against, 72 against 120 people. These men knew that their fate was written. They knew because, as we mentioned last night, that Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, when he had all the men in the tent on the night of Ashura and they were re-pledging their allegiance to Abu Abdullah, they knew that they would be slain on the day of Ashura. They knew that the 10th of Muharram is, there was no reprieve after that day. That was the day that these enemies were going to do what they were sent to do by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, and what the cursed Yazid had ordered for that to happen. That the bayat either comes, the hand comes of allegiance, or the head comes to him. Abu Abdullah alayhi salam had a young son in his mid-20s or so, Ali al-Akbar, or maybe a bit older than that. Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, the young man who bravely defended, and was the first from the family to go on the day of Ashura. On the day of Ashura, brothers and sisters, when Abu Abdullah was addressing the enemy troops, he made a statement to them, and he said to them in a loud voice from his side, he says, Malak, he says, what is wrong with you people? What is wrong with you? Don't you understand who we are? He says, Qata Allahu rahimak kama qata'ta rahimi. May Allah kill your progeny. May Allah destroy your progeny, just as you are going to cut away at my progeny one after the other. He says, you have no respect for my relationship to the Messenger of Allah, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And it was on that day of Ashura, brothers and sisters, that when Ali al-Akbar would eventually go to the battlefield, that Abu Abdullah would make that very poignant statement where he would remind the people, where he would say, Allahumma shahad ala ha'ula il-qawm. He said to them, he said, O Allah, you bear witness against this community. فَقَدْ بَرَزَ إِلَيْهِمْ أَشْبَهُ النَّاسِ بِرَسُولِكَ مُحَمَّدٍ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ وَسَلَّمْ خَلْقًا وَخُلْقًا وَمَنْتِقًا. He says that you, Allah, bear witness that these people are coming to fight and kill this individual who is the most close in resemblance to Rasulullah, to your Prophet. Not only in resemblance, he says, in khalq and in khulq and in mantikan, meaning that in the way he looks, he was the closest in resemblance to Rasulullah. In his akhlaq, in his demeanor, in the way he carried himself, he was the closest to Rasulullah. In the way he spoke, Abu Abdullah says he was the closest in the way he spoke as Rasulullah used to be. Abu Abdullah says, وَكُنَّا إِذَا اشْتَقْنَا إِلَى رُؤْيَةِ النَّبِيِّكِ نَظَرْنَا إِلَيْهِ, that whenever we longed to see the face of Rasulullah, who had already passed away, whenever we longed to remember the akhlaq of Rasulullah, we would look at the akhlaq of Ali al-Akbar. Whenever we wanted to remember how Rasulullah spoke, the way that he spoke, the eloquence that he had, the tone that the Prophet carried when he spoke, we would listen to Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam. This is the man, brothers and sisters, that was there on the day of Ashura. He was there to defend his father. He was there to defend his imam. He was there to defend the religion of Islam. And as we know, on that day of Ashura, as Ali al-Akbar gets the permission from his father to go to the battlefield, and he makes his way on his horse into the battlefield, after he has received the permissions and the farewells from the women, from the children, from his mother, he goes and he begins the fight, and he says those words of poetry where he says, I am Ali, the son of Hussein, the son of Ali. He says, I swear by the Lord of the house that we are the deserving ones of the Prophet. He says, I will strike with my sword defending my father, striking bravely like a man from the Banu Hashim, from the children of Ali. I swear by Allah that the sinners will not overrule us. As Ali al-Akbar says these words, he goes into the battlefield like a ferocious lion. Although, like the others, he has not had food or water, he has not been able to quench his thirst in this difficult day of Ashura. The heat of the day of Ashura has been pounding upon him. And as the books of Maqtal mention, that Ali al-Akbar fights bravely in this first round of his attack. He defends his father and he defends the religion from all of these enemies who are surrounding him. Historians mention that he kills over 100 of the enemy forces in his first attack on the day of Ashura. He comes eventually back on his horse and he says to his father, he says, oh my dear father, he says, this atash is qad qatalani, that the thirst is killing me. He says that the armor on my body, the weight of the armor is bearing down on me. He says that, do you have any water that you can give me, even a drink of water that I could quench my thirst, that I could alleviate some of the difficulties of the heat of this day, that I can go back and defend and fight and serve your cause? But what could Imam Hussein say to his son, oh brothers and sisters? What can he give his son? What water can he give him? What kind of consolation can he give him? He turns to his son and he says, oh my dear son Ali al-Akbar, he says, go and fight a little bit longer. Soon you will be quenched by the fountain of Rasulullah. My grandfather Muhammad Rasulullah will come and quench you with such a thirst, with such a water. He will quench your thirst and you will never feel thirsty after this. As Ali al-Akbar is getting ready to go back into the battlefield, Abu Abdullah tells him, he says, oh my son Ali, he says, before you go back into the enemy's grips, before you go back into the battlefield, I want you to go to the tent of the women. I want you to go back into the tent of the children. You hear the children screaming, Al-Atash, Al-Atash. You hear that you know your mother was praying for you. You know the women are making prayer for you. Go back and see them in this last time, this time of loneliness that they're feeling, this time of ghurba, this time of difficulty that the women and children are facing. Go to the women and bid them farewell one last time. Go to the little children and one last time bid them farewell before you go back into the battlefield. As Ali al-Akbar goes into the tent and he says goodbye to his mother, he says goodbye to the little children, he says goodbye to the ladies of the family of the Prophet, he says his farewells and he leaves. He comes out of the tent, he goes back to his father, he bids his father the last farewell, and then he makes his way back into the battlefield. As he begins his second assault on the enemy soldiers, as he begins to kill many of the soldiers one after the other, one of the enemy soldiers, or one of the enemies in the camps, named Murra al-Abdi, he says, he proclaims out that Umar ibn Sa'd hears him. He says, I would deserve the burden of sins of all of the Arabs if I do not make this man's father cry and weep over him. And so as he says these words, he sneaks up behind Hazrat Ali al-Akbar and he attacks him from behind. Historians say that he has a spear in his hand and he takes the spear from behind Ali al-Akbar. He could never come in front and attack because he knew that if he attacked him from the front that he would be confronted by Ali al-Akbar. And so as a coward, he comes from the back. He does a sneak attack and he stabs Ali al-Akbar in the back with the spear. He stabs him in the back with the spear and it lodges all the way into his chest. He then hits Ali al-Akbar on the head with a sword. Ali Akbar's head begins to split open. The blood begins to fall over his face. As he falls onto the plains of Karbala from his horse, he lets out that last salam to his father. He says, Alaika minni salam, ya Aba Abdullah. He says, Hada Jaddi, this is my grandfather, oh my dear father. He's come to grant me a drink. He's come to give me a glass of water. And he tells me to drink from this water. He says that once you drink from this water, that you will not have any thirst after this. And he's saying to me, to tell to you, oh my dear father, he's saying that, oh Hussein, he says to you, oh father, that come to us, that we have a glass of water ready for you also to drink, to quench your thirst on this day of Ashura.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come, the crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
You're listening to Husseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. May our peace and salutations be upon you, Imam Hussein. I send my condolences to you, brothers and sisters, for the tragic event of Karbala. We were talking about benefiting truly from Ziyarat Ashura, this great gift from our fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Today we're going to talk about the last station, the spiritual journey that we were talking about, that first, the first part was bala, meaning that calamity that happened upon Imam Hussein. The second part is having huzn and grief for this bala. And the third is aligning ourselves, our mind, body, and soul with Imam Hussein. The fourth part is after we do this, we take these necessary steps during Muharram or during throughout the year. We ask Allah to make us reach al-maqam al-mahmud, the praiseworthy station. As we read in Ziyarat al-Ashura, وَأَسْأَلُهُ أَن يُبَلِّغَنِي al-maqam al-mahmud lakum عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. I ask him to make me attain the praiseworthy status that you enjoin with Allah. What is al-maqam al-mahmud? The praiseworthy status in the Quran is for the Holy Prophet of Islam. And some